Folks, this is Screen Watching. Screen Watching, for those who came in late, it's a podcast. We talk about the screens. We talk about the things on the screens. That's movies. That's TV shows. That's just what I've been watching on the screens. It could be OnlyFans accounts. Like, it could be anything. We talk about all of that. We have opinions. We have disagreements. We've got disagreements based on each other's opinions. Folks, there's a lot going on. But before we get onto it, permission to come on board. This is Screen Watching.
This is not like TV, only better.
Television! Teacher! Mother!
Secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Folks, this is Screen Watching. My name, Dan Barrett, joined here by Simon Foster, my boy Wonder. How are you, sir?
Daniel Barrett, I'm very well. It's lovely to talk to you in this week where we've got some very interesting titles, some sort of left field titles that we're going to have a look at both in the arenas of film and television. I'm very excited to talk with you about the what's on the plate today.
Yeah, look, we've got a bit of a grab bag of just interesting stuff that's around. I've got the new Hulu/Disney Plus series called Death and Other Details. It's a Agatha Christie style, supposedly Agatha Christie inspired TV series, like a limited series. But I would say the inspirations aren't quite Agatha Christie, but we'll talk about that in just a moment. All right. You're going to talk about The Iron Claw, which is the new A24 film debuting in cinemas this week. We're also going to have a bit of a chat about All of Us Strangers, which I assume is a cinema movie. I don't know what it is. A bit of discussion about Boy Swallows Universe, Priscilla, a look back at Sorcerer. Folks, there is so much up for discussion. And I mean, we can only really get into it. There's only one way to get into it, Simon. Simon.
Before we jump into reviews, I want to mention very quickly.
Here's the thing. Here's what I'm worried about right now. The last couple of weeks, the conversation's like, we've got to keep this under an hour. And then I look at the run sheet. And then I'll keep on seeing like segment after segment after segment added. And then even when there's not segments added, suddenly Simon at the very beginning of the podcast just introduces a little conversational element like, hey, let's talk about the Golden Globes. Let's talk about the Emmys. And then suddenly 25 minutes of extra content in the podcast.
Which our fans are grateful for. Both of them love what we do. Look, we should mention the Emmys. We really should mention the Emmys because it was a good show. They put on a really good show. Everything kind of clicked into place. We've spoken online and in your newsletter and all that stuff about it, but I think we should mention that good, best reviews in ages, bad, lowest ratings on record, but that's not too surprising coming off the back of the embarrassment that was the Golden Globes.
That's got nothing to do with that. Okay, Simon, if you're going to make statements along the way, we need to address what it actually is. Okay, so we'll put aside the good because we're going to talk about the good. The bad ratings, it's actually kind of just a really unfortunate situation for the Emmys. It's got nothing to do with the Golden Globes. What it's got to do with is that, and we're talking about US ratings here, it aired on Monday night up against the football, which is not something that the Emmys usually up against. So that's immediately going to cause massive diminishment in ratings. But also that same night was the first Iowa caucus. It was the Republicans nominating their person who, you know, it's always going to go one way. But that's still going to siphon off a certain percentage of the viewers who are older, which is the audience for the Emmys. So even if the Golden Globes hadn't stunk up the world, it still wouldn't have had any impact because the football, the politics, like it was just a big night of TV for the US.
There was all that. Yeah, look, you're right. I guess I'm right too in that there probably was a little bit of award season stink about the whole thing. But the fact is they put on a great show. There were some memorable moments. They honored television. They made doing an award show look surprisingly effortless and thoroughly charming in the way it was put together. So kudos to the team behind the Emmys this year. I guess the only thing that was missing was a sort of a bit of tension about who was going to win. Pretty much all the expected winners won.
For the most part.
So, yeah, good for the most part. So 2024 Emmys, thumbs up. Let's talk about movies and TV shows.
Well, no, because you opened the Pandora's box now, so we have to do it.
I know, I have. Say anything.
Well, you didn't say anything. And so, well, you just said, oh, Emmy's good. But I kind of feel that people come to this podcast for a deeper insight. So here we go. This is what I'm going to drop. So the reason the Emmys were so good was that they, usually with these awards, they'll be like, oh, we're going to play into nostalgia a bit. And then I'll have some sort of montage where they look at like a couple of great moments from years gone by, maybe some sort of a theme around it. Or they'll do the really hacky thing, which is, hey, let's play some of our favorite theme songs from over the years. The problem with the theme songs bit is that you start playing the theme songs and then all the good theme songs dry up like about 1996 when they stopped having regular theme songs on TV shows. And then you kind of don't really have anything after that. So that's like 25 years of TV without good theme songs. So that gambit never really works. But they lent into nostalgia in other ways, which was bringing back TV stars of yesteryear, where every award given away, with the exception of Colbert with his new sort of ingenue on stage together, but every other award were people from the, I'm going to say history of television, but it's really like the last like 45 years of television, because spoiler alert, people die, and it's a bit hard to get some of the older sort of talent at this point. But from the last 40 odd years of TV, they had, you know, luminaries who were regularly there dropping awards.
Notable.
But also for a couple of the segments as well, they brought back proper casts of programs and like recreated their like sets, which I thought was
great.
Very clever. And that really worked. What I wanted to leave people with is just this overall thought, which was I was watching the Cheers section, which was the highlight of the program by a long shot, because Cheers. Okay, watching that, and then I was trying to find a photo of the Cheers gang up on the stage again. A big Woody Harrelson sized hole on that. I found out this morning, apparently, the reason Woody Harrelson wasn't there wasn't a lack of interest. It was actually just because he was in London doing a play. So getting him to LA to record that just was a bit of a non-starter.
Impossible, but no Shelley Long photo. Yeah.
No,
and
but
Kirstie Alley was on it in the memoriam. But no Shelley Long on the Cheers stage.
The producers wouldn't comment on the Shelley Long thing, which makes me suggest that she turned it down. And that's fine. You know, whatever. Sorry, you just led me to a second thought, and I put this in my newsletter the other day. There's something interesting about Cheers, which is that Cheers, hugely successful show, runs 11 years. Ted Danson, very much the star of that program and the center of that very good ensemble cast. Ted Danson, I'm sure, would agree that that show is nothing without the broader ensemble, but he was absolutely the center of it. So you've got that. And then you also had the spin-off series where there's Hook Frazier, starring Kelsey Grammer, off for another successful, what was that for, like 12 years, I think it ran for? It was another long-running sitcom, hugely successful, and these days probably better remembered, but that's recency bias more than anything else. Okay, Cheers, still the better program, putting it out there. Certainly over the length of the series. But you've got these two stars as part of this Cheers section where Ted Danson, if you're going to talk about this being the Cheers cast, then Kelsey Grammer can only be part of that ensemble and Ted Danson absolutely needs to helm that conversation. But if you watched what they did there, it was different to every other segment throughout the program. They had Kelsey Grammer literally step away from the Cheers set with Rhea Perlman to introduce a second award, because I'm sure that Kelsey Grammer was, I'm not going to be the second banana to Ted Danson. I'm like a hugely successful star myself.
I want my moment.
Like, I'm sure that was negotiated. Anyway, I just thought that was very funny. But my overall big thought, my big thought was, as I was trying to find a photo of the Cheers gang up there, I had to go onto this dreaded site called Twitter, because that's where people post things immediately. So I was able to find the picture pretty easily. Okay. But I just saw a lot of conversation about people saying, Cheers, I've always meant to get around to watching that. And, like, fair enough, Cheers hasn't been on the air now for 30 years. Ended up in, like, 92. Yeah, 92. So, you know, it's over 30 years at this point. It's been a long time. Understandably, a lot of people haven't seen it. And in this day and age where a lot of people are only seeing older programs if they're available on Netflix, because people don't watch shows on repeats anymore, like, you know, I've seen plenty of shows from yesteryear because I grew up watching broadcast TV. Things get repeated. Now people have to make an active choice to go and watch something. And nobody's making an active choice to sign up to Paramount Plus, let alone to watch Cheers on Paramount Plus, because there's other stuff. So there's so many barriers to entry to discover Cheers and how good it is these days. I just saw so many people say, I've never seen this program. Okay. And fair. The greatest thing that Paramount could do for Cheers and its ongoing legacy is to drop it onto Netflix for 2 years, do them a sweetheart deal. Netflix will absolutely go for Cheers. Like, there's no way they're not going to accept it. Drop it onto Cheers, give it 2 to 3 years on it, and then reap the benefits for like another 30 years.
It's an interesting point you make, and we should be getting into reviews, but I do just want to raise one thing. You did mention in your newsletter in the last 24 hours or so, as we record this, that you returned or that you watched for the first time San Elmo's Fire, which I thought was an interesting movie to choose from. And you intimated in your newsletter that it was not a pleasurable experience for you. And I'm one, because for me, I now see the problems with that movie, but I understand it being part of a generational thing, and that you referred to it with regards to the Brat Pack documentary that Andrew McCarthy's putting together that's coming to Hulu later in the year. My point being is that that San Elmo's Fire is now 39 years old. If we were doing this podcast in 1985 and we were commenting on films that were 39 years old, we would be talking about movies from 1946. Now, that includes amongst them that classic Disney film Song of the South, as well as classics like It's a Wonderful Life and so on and so forth. So it's extraordinary for me to think of a time where San Elmo's Fire was completely relevant and completely at the forefront of everyone's discussion about the week in movies and the year in movies, and a whole generation went towards this film as being indicative of attitudes and mores and opinions of the time. And now 39 years later, we're looking back and making judgment about it, but I think we have to put that into perspective.
Okay. Now we're just, okay, I'm just looking at the end of our run sheet and seeing what we can drop off from the tail end of this podcast. So look, there's a couple of things to keep in mind here. One, the difference between if we were doing this podcast and, boy, if we were doing a podcast in 1980, what year was it? 84?
85. We'd be at the front of the curve, wouldn't we? 85.
Well, yeah, we're really podcasting pioneers if we're doing that. but putting that aside, the difference between the mid-80s to the mid-2020s, oh my God, is that we live in an era now where there's greater media permanence and access to media. So the reason I watched St. Elmo's Fire a couple of months ago was just purely that I'd spent like the year beforehand quite regularly listening to Rob Lowe's podcast, which has mixed pleasures. Sure. And he's just always talking about St. Elmo's Fire. And I realized I've never seen St. Elmo's Fire. I can give it a watch. So it's not actually that interesting that I watched it when you think about the context as to why I watched it. But the reason why I didn't like St. Elmo's Fire is because I just don't think as a film it holds up particularly well. Okay, I don't think it's any because of any sort of, problematic material where, yeah, there's a little bit of that in there, but that's not really a thing. It's just that I feel that sort of a movie existed as almost what they call a programmer, but designed to really speak to the youth culture of the moment. Like those were all the hot stars and they were there engaging in a way that sort of made sense for the mid-80s. Take it outside of that context, and I just don't think the film's really got a whole lot to it. But the other thing that's happened since the 1980s is that when that film dropped originally, there weren't really many TV shows that were talking to that audience. It's one, talking to that audience, but two, talking to the audience with those kind of characters. We've seen so many other TV shows over the years that could effectively be called St. Elmo's Fire, the TV series. I mean, like St. Elmo's Fire, like there's no difference between that and say Felicity or like any number of youth dramas we've seen over the years. Yeah. I mean, just keeping things like in the pure drama category. Okay, and like, you know, there's been so many TV shows and a bunch of movies. So just in the greater scheme,
Yeah, no, I understand. As someone who was there at the time, you're absolutely right in that analysis. St. Elmo's Fire came along when TV was either skewed very family and very young, like the Blossoms and
well, these this sort is of pre Blossom by about sitcoms. 5-7 years. Yeah.
My point being is that there was a gap there, or there was some of the more growing up sort of television stuff or more traditional television action. So you're right, there was a gap in the TV market that wasn't addressing me, wasn't addressing. So those films, that film and the Brat Pack era became very important. It was also the time when Gossip Mags and were at the height of their fame
The key media you're missing here, Simon, is MTV.
Yeah, but
no, keep in mind,
St. Elmo's Fire played upon, and I mean, got its momentum going by the song. And MTV didn't address
the
dramatics of the period.
No, no, it's not a like for like, it's the culture of the moment. So we have a weird relationship with MTV in Australia where we didn't really have it. Okay, like there was a weekly MTV program that used to air, but like it wasn't like there was a constant presence in people's homes. What happened in the early 80s with the rise of MTV is suddenly there was like an untapped vein of youth culture being brought into households across America, which hadn't really previously existed. So what it's doing is it wasn't like MTV were in the early to mid 80s producing a whole bunch of drama shows with like the hot young talent, but these were movies that were MTV influenced. They had music that was reflective of stuff that was in there. The rise of like these young actors coming through was very much just reflective of that MTV culture being reflected backwards and forwards between movies and TV shows. And it was kind of just part of the cultural mix. But MTV is absolutely a core reason as to why the early to mid 80s onwards suddenly saw that massive influx of youth oriented movies and dramas.
Yeah. Well, the decision was made that the teenage audience was the, had the highest disposable income, was the audience to bring people back to the cinemas. This all happened, I mean, this is nothing new to anyone listening to screen watching. We've discussed this before and most people understand this anyway. But in the wake of non-star-driven vehicles like Star Wars and Jaws and that era of movie going, suddenly teenagers were back in cinemas. And when things like Friday the 13th and Porky start making a lot of money, studios and television executives realize that teenagers are the go-to market. Has the industry ever recovered from that? I don't know, but it certainly profited from it at the time.
Yeah.
We really should talk about reviews.
Well, we should. Let's not talk about reviews. Let's do reviews.
It stinks.
Hey, Simon, can I kick things off this week? Do you mind?
No, not at all. Knock yourself out.
Okay, I want to talk about a new TV program, a drama limited series. It's airing on Disney Plus here in Australia, but it's a Hulu original in the US. It's called Death and Other Details.
Can't believe we're going to be trapped on this thing for 10 days. I'm so sorry I dragged you into this.
Pay attention. If you want to solve a crime, you must first learn to see through the illusion. Details matter.
Simon, I want to talk to you about this program, Death and Other Details, but first, I think we need to provide a little bit of groundwork, a little bit of context. We're going to drop some of this in. So this last week, we saw the 25th anniversary of a show called The Sopranos. When The Sopranos dropped, I'm drawing a long bow here. When The Sopranos dropped on HBO, what it did is sort of kickstarted a change in the way that a lot of TV shows were made and what was being considered. We saw the rise of what they were calling premium TV or prestige TV, which then led to peak TV and whatever. All phrases that listeners to this podcast are familiar with. I mean, it was always incorrect to say that The Sopranos was the entry point into prestige TV. Like, there's a lot of complexities to that as an idea. But taking that on sort of surface value, we saw The Sopranos, and then we saw shows like FX's The Shield, Sex and the City, a whole bunch of high-quality drama series that dealt largely with what they call difficult men as like their primary things, but lots of things that were very sort of textually rich and a lot more grown up than what you were seeing from a lot of network TV, supposedly. So went the theory. Okay, but what we saw in its wake was just a whole bunch of shows come around which tried to emulate the HBO experience on screen, okay, but they were network shows. They couldn't really have the violence or the nudity or the bad language, and quite often they didn't really have the actual like meaty texture that these HBO programs had. Instead, they were, and HBO, I'm just using a stand-in for, you know, cable dramas. They just didn't really have the substantial value of it. But you saw them make the effort anyway. Another trend that you always see, and this is the thing with TV, is that as soon as something is popular, there'll be in the next year or two, and this is more of a network drama thing than you find on streaming, but it certainly happens there a little bit, is that you find a whole bunch of other TV shows that come up in its wake. So if you think about sort of post-Lost, the next year, every TV show had like a mystery box at the center of it, and they were all ran for about 10 episodes at least. And there were questions introduced at that first thing.
There's a Parker Lewis. I know exactly what you're saying.
Pretty much, but it's always just more widespread. It's never like there's just that one for one like. There's like another five things that crop up in its wake. So, cut to this program called Death and Other Details. And what you've got here is a show that is every bit the successor of a little show called The White Lotus. But when I was thinking about The White Lotus, they're like, ah, we just kind of need that special something else. Hey, have you ever seen that movie Triangle of Sadness? Let's do White Lotus, but set on a boat and do it a bit like Triangle of Sadness. So that's kind of what we've got here in terms of the tone of this program. Okay, but what's interesting, why I kind of want us to reference The Sopranos and that rise of premium dramas that sort of came up in its wake, is this feels like it's kind of following that same playbook. Okay, but the difference here is that it's for a streamer and not for a network drama, which is weird because everything about this feels like one of those try-hard dramas that cropped up post-Sopranos on ABC, NBC, and CBS back in the day.
Get it.
All long right. Burst of draw. Okay. I just want to establish the... Yeah, sorry, go.
The only point I want to make is that not having seen this, and only having watched the trailer for it, I might also suggest, and correct me if I'm wrong, that this is also coming about in the wake of Knives Out and the two and Glass Onion. Is it a similar sort of zing and feel to it? As an Agatha Christie mystery, that kind of what this felt like to me.
Yeah, look, I mean, that's fair. And I was probably about to drop Knives Out and the next thing I was going to say, which was that the story mechanics of this is basically that it's a Agatha Christie style whodunit sort of parlor kind of a thing. So think about this very much in the vein of something a bit more like Murder on the Orient Express than like Knives Out, but there's certainly elements being drawn from, I guess, the contemporary nature of Knives Out. But Knives Out took it purely from like that Agatha Christie sort of model. So you've got that element, but there's something about this where they certainly take the murder mystery aspects of Agatha Christie, but it leans so much more towards White Lotus than anything else. It tries to be maybe sort of sexually honest. You've got some characters that are fairly reprehensible around the place. Like there is so much White Lotus as its DNA sprinkled through this. It's incredible.
Yeah. Okay.
The plot of this, you've got Mandy Patinkin, okay, who is a supposedly the world's greatest detective, which is weird because he's not Batman, but anyway. So you got Mandy Patinkin as the world's greatest detective. I'm not sure how many, it's 18 years. They literally tell us this at the beginning. 18 years prior, he was hired by this wealthy family to investigate the death of a family friend. The family friend it was a family friend. They were just visiting like the wealthy family. They'd gone out to their car. It was like the woman and her daughter. The daughter had to go back into the house, and you see why in the show. Daughter had to go back into the house, and as she was running away from the house, running away from the car to do this, the car exploded. So the mother died, and so this wealthy family have more or less sort of taken in this young girl, okay, but then also hired this detective to.
This is all before they get on the boat.
This is all in the first 30 seconds of the program.
Good.
And this is part of the problem with the program as well. So we've got that as the opening scene. And then we jump forward 18 years where we see that they're all on this expensive cruise liner taking a cruise. Okay. Very Triangle of Sadness in terms of its wealth and the way that the staff are engaging with the wealthy people as well. You've got this. There's a murder that takes place. Which I can't think of the name of the actor now. I want to say his name is Paul Gladys, who people would know from Mad Men from the first couple of seasons. He's hilarious, and boy, has he chunked up a bit since the Mad Men days. But anyway, he's in this. There's a murder that takes place. And then we jump back after the murder and then the opening title sequence 2 days prior, where suddenly we find all the characters and we get introduced to them. But here's the problem with the mechanics of this program, which is exactly what I've said. We started 18 years ago. We jumped forward 18 years ago. We jumped back 2 days prior. But in each of those sections is a lot of exposition explaining what's going on in each individual era. And so it gets really egregious when you go 18 years into the future and then 2 days prior, where you've got the woman who more or less runs the staff on the boats, and she gives a... I'm trying to remember the order that actually ends up happening. Sorry, in the initial thing, you get introduced to everyone and understand what their perspectives are, but then it flashes back 2 days where you go through all of those characters again because you're a simpleton and can't remember what happened 35 seconds prior, okay? And then she explains who they all are in a way that doesn't really make sense, and why would this woman running the boat talk about these characters in the way that she does and frames whether they're good people or bad people and where they're coming from, because it doesn't actually impact the staff. And just, if anything, actually means that your staff are more than likely to have negative experiences with these staff. It's counter to what this woman's trying to achieve. So either she's just a bad employee.
I'm already exhausted by this.
But that's not it. You are exhausted.
I'm already exhausted.
But this is what I'm trying to get to with it, which is it is exhausting. And by the time that you go through and be introduced to everyone like 17 times, you're kind of done with the program. And it's a little bit of a shame because by the time you reach the end of the first episode, you're actually kind of engaged because the murder mystery element of it is actually quite good. And what they're setting up with the various players on the boats is actually kind of interesting. But boy, it takes you about 35 minutes to want to get rid of the stink of the first 10 minutes of the program. Okay, because you are tapped out at that point. If people are dropping away from the program after that opening, like, I understand. And it's not that the end is so rewarding. Well, I just want to say, it's not that the end is so rewarding that it makes the first sort of chore worthwhile, because it's not. But at least when you reach the end of it, you're like, I could see myself watching episode two.
Okay, all right. So your reviews kind of reflect, like, I dipped into Rotten Tomatoes and had a look at what they were saying about it, and it's getting some fairly dire reviews, mainly because the reviewers are saying, this is not a 10-episode show. This is an 8-episode show that has been convoluted out to 10 episodes. It's way too dense and mixy-mixy to engage over a long period of time. So maybe that could be the path you're headed down.
This is the problem. It's not dense. The only reason it feels dense is because they go in these circuitous ways to explain what characters' relationships are with each other, and there's lots of busy work and stuff that doesn't need to exist. It's not an 8-episode series from what I've seen from the first couple. It's like a 2-3-episode series at best, with just a whole lot of guff taking place. Again, it's yet another movie that's been spun out into a limited series.
Death and Other Details is on Disney Plus or on Hulu, I'm guessing, in the US.
Can I say some positive things? One, Mandy Patinkin, like, you know, who doesn't want to watch that?
Yep.
I mean, he's the main guy. Like, you know, you're watching it for Mandy Patinkin and he holds you in.
Sure.
The other co-lead on it is this actress named Violet Bean. I didn't know her, but apparently she was a supporting actor on The Flash for a couple of seasons, or at least like a recurring character. She's fairly charming, and the two of them make for a good sort of on-pair coupling. There's actually some really good supporting actors coupled throughout the series. You've got the guy who is playing Freddy the Son in the Frasier sequel series at the moment, and I can't think of that dude's name right now. I should have brought up the IMDb before I delve too far into this. But he's in it, and I think he's genuinely quite good. You can't tell that from the first couple of episodes of Frasier. But certainly as that series went on, like, I think that he really sort of came to the forefront as being one of the rules of people to watch on that program. And the actor's name is Jack Cutmore Scott. Great name. But then also just throughout the series as well, you've got people like Tambola Perry, who's not in the first couple of episodes much, but I'm sure she'll be into it in a bigger way. People who probably know her best from The Good Fight. She played a judge with some duplicitous issues going on in her world, but she's fairly good. Michael Gladys, who's the guy that was in Mad Men, he plays a guy who may not be all that he seems, although that's probably true for every character on this. Who knows what the secrets they're hiding? Even Mandy Patinkin, he's got some stuff going on. But the voice I really wanted to throw out there was, and I've never known how to pronounce his name, I think it's Jer Burns or Jer Burns. He's a guy that I know from years ago being in that TV sitcom from the late 80s, early 90s, Dear John, which is a remake of a British sitcom. And that was about a support group for people who've just recently gotten divorced. Influential sitcom for me as a preteen. So I've always remembered him from that. But when you see this guy by face, you'd be like, oh, I've seen him in 45,000 different TV shows and movies over the years.
A working actor.
I want to say he's very much a working actor, but like he's a memorable working actor. I'm not a character actor. He's just a working actor. Anyway, yeah. Something so right as a sitcom that he was in for a few seasons that people might remember. Oh, and Death sorry, looking and at the IMDb, he did a Blossom playing himself.
Hey, to call back to Blossom, playing himself?
Yeah, because really? It was 1991 well, 1991 for Blossom, and he was a big TV star at the time because of Dear John, so he's probably there for that.
Oh, okay. Wow. Two Blossom mentions in one episode. Three, if I look at the running sheet further on. Excellent. okay, so Death and Other Details on Disney Plus and Hulu in the US. 10-episode arc. Could be a bit of a slog, but it looks pretty in parts, and if you enjoy a mystery, maybe worth checking out.
Kind of.
My God. All right. Well, I got off to the movies last night with my beautiful wife, and we saw the new Zac Efron film, The Iron Claw.
Ever since I was a child, people said my family was cursed. Mom tried to protect us with God. Pop tried to protect us with wrestling. He said if we were the toughest, the strongest, nothing could ever hurt us. I believed him. We all did.
Look, this is typical of Simon Foster. He introduced that saying, the new Zac Efron movie. The hotness in this movie is not Zac Efron.
Oh, here we go. What is it?
Did you watch the Emmy Awards on Monday?
Yeah, Jeremy Allen White. Okay, let me get around to what Jeremy Allen White does for this film. Let me get around to what Zac Efron does for this film as well. This is the true story of a wrestling family. Now, I know you're a huge fan of World Championship Wrestling, and you'll enjoy the way that they portray the meteoric rise, stardom, and, of course, terrible fall of the Von Erich family. This was a group of young men back in the early 80s who were led by a fierce patriarch played by, and this is where I should have had my IMDb page open, Holt McCallany. Now, I hope I pronounced that right, from Mindhunter, who we all know as the great actor who fronts that TV series. As the father in this film, he is a force of nature. He is driving his boys to be exactly the kind of success in the wrestling ring that he could never be. He came close, but things fell apart for him. And now these four boys are underneath his spell. The four boys are played by Zac Efron, who I've mentioned. He plays Kevin. The body transformation that Efron has undergone to play this part, to be authentic as a small town wrestler trying to make it big, is just extraordinary. His face is certainly recognizable. It's Zac Efron, but his body, it reminded me very much of the old condom stuff with walnuts gag about how Clive James described Arnold Schwarzenegger. That's what Zac Efron looks like. Also in the mix is Harris Dickinson, who many will know from A Murder at the End of the World. We just saw on Disney Plus and Hulu. He was central to that. Stanley Simons, who plays Mike, the youngest of the boys, who doesn't really want to be a wrestler. He's more artistic. He's got his focus on becoming a musician. And then coming back into the family when President Carter's administration denies the Olympic team going to Moscow is Kerry, played by your man Jeremy Allen White, who you're right is everywhere at the moment because he's winning all the awards for The Bear. He has also undergone an extraordinary body transformation to play this wrestling family firebrand, I guess you could say. He has a lot of the big moments in this film, in a film full of really big moments. So what unfolds is a not groundbreaking sports drama that shows how the failed dreams of the father are cast upon the sons and they go through terrible life moments because of that very selfish way of parenting. But it does hit all the right buttons in terms of its emotional impact. And central to that is Efron, who firmly believes that the Von Erich curse is in place. His family is going through some terrible moments because of this long-held belief that they're cursed for some reason, to the point that it starts breaking up his marriage with Lily James, who's terrific in a central part. Also great to see on screen as the wife and mother of the boys is the wonderful Maura Tierney, who we know from ER and so many great shows along the way, small screen
news
star,
radio
really transitioned to. And news radio, of course, never really transitioned to big screen fame, but is in her sort of more mature years, she's proving to be a really commanding screen presence here in this one and holds her own against Holt McCallany, I guess is how you say it, in some really tough moments back at home. It's hard to watch sometimes because I had a real week of bad patriarchy this week because I also saw The Color Purple the other night, which I'll review next week. And there was a lot of scenes. There's been a lot of really tough sort of domestic moments on screen this week. But, oh boy, just seeing the way this is put together, the action scenes, the wrestling scenes in this one are not overly stylized, but they're presented in such a way that It shows these boys absolutely transform into monsters of the sport when they get into the ring. And Jeremy Allen White and Zac Efron and Harris Dickinson obviously went through some incredible training to pull off this. So not a groundbreaker in any way, but certainly a really, I remember saying after we saw it last night, it's a very solid, very sturdy bit of cinema and a really sort of well put together drama.
Yeah. Maura Tierney, I think probably worth noting, she had a pretty strong 90s with not only a mainstream sitcom, but in her, you know, years away from the show, time away from the show, she did films like Liar Liar, Primary Colors, Primal Fear, a whole bunch of great things. Her career highlight obviously being, well, not even character actor, I think just, you know, working actor. Her career highlight being Welcome to Mooseport, the final film of Gene Hackman's, co-starring Ray Romano.
Yeah, real highlight for everyone involved. I'm there was a lot of early buzz on this film as in the award season. It's kind of been overshadowed and overtaken. I did read in one of the trades this morning that Zac Efron is firming as sort of an outsider chance for best actor nod, and I wouldn't be surprised at all by that. He's really good in this part. But the film itself, I mean, if the standard bearer is something like Raging Bull, this doesn't get anywhere near that kind of quality in terms of the harsh impact of ambition in sport. But it certainly hits all the marks that it has to be a really satisfying film.
Is it as satisfying as Welcome to Mooseport?
Well, what is really? Come on. I don't think I've ever seen question. Welcome to Mooseport.
You know what? It's not terrible.
Yeah. I like Ray Romano, eh?
Well, I do like Ray Romano, but anyway, that's neither here nor there.
I don't know why.
Simon, are we going to segue over to a little segment we call The Intermission?
Oh, let's do that right now.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's intermission time.
We had a little bit of a back and forth this week, and recalling some of the sadder, more impactful moments of television over the years when one of our favourite characters died. TV's memorable final moments is what I've called the intermission this week. Prepared statement, I say, we all love a good cry, and the passing of our favourite TV characters has always provided fans with an emotional catharsis that helps to define the hold that television has on viewers. It's good for ratings too. Quote, see the most shocking moment of the TV year this week on Blossom. So we thought we'd get all misty-eyed with each other, recalling those on-screen deaths that hit particularly hard on first viewing and have lingered long in our hearts and minds. This was inspired by your viewing of one of your favourite shows over the years and the very significant passing of a central character. Do you want to take it from here and just put that in context?
Okay, well, look, I mean, you said one of my favourite shows from over the years. This is a show I hadn't seen for 30 years, up until about a month or two ago. I've been doing a LA Law rewatch. So part of the reason I started watching LA Law again was, one, it always just felt like it was one of those sort of high-quality programs, or programs that at least had moments of high quality, even if it was a bit generically 80s and 90s. And that's probably the best way to define it. Is it a little bit generic in some senses? But there are moments where it really reaches up and is amongst the best hours of TV that you'll ever see, and then others which just kind of hours of TV. But one of the reasons why I wanted to start watching it is because in the many years it hasn't really been available, there was one scene from the program that was always widely available. And it's an incredible scene.
I think it's a mistake to just capitulate on the tax abatements.
Well, what's the point? Wasting the time of six attorneys? Fighting over a moot point?
It's not a moot point, Leland. It's a contingency. It's what every good lawyer plans for.
Rosalind, I'm sorry I can't marry you.
This isn't about that.
This is about that. For the past week, I've been getting nothing but resentment. You know that's true.
I don't resent you, Leland. If anything, maybe I resent myself.
For staying with a man who doesn't love you.
I really don't want to talk about it. Ah!
Oh! Rosalind! Oh! Oh, my God!
So So look, I've seen that scene so many times, and the scene is hilarious for a number of reasons. One, I knew a little bit about the character that was being bumped off, and to know that they killed off that character in that way, so I wouldn't say carelessly, I'd say so heartlessly, to see her just disappear into that elevator well like that. But then also, what really stuck with me is the conversation leading up to her falling in there, where it just felt so stilted and strange with Leland saying, oh, I'm just not in love with you anymore. And it's like, what even is that about? Like, how could this be so awful, okay, in so many ways? So I always figured that contextually it was going to be a bit more interesting. And then I've done the LA Law rewatch in part so I could watch the entire build up to that scene take place. Okay, like this is the driving force behind me wanting to see this. And having seen several seasons of the show leading to it, like, it makes all the sense in the world. And it's a great moment of TV, amplified by the fact that I've actually seen it with context now, which is great. But if you don't know LA Law, and I'd imagine that's most people at this point, because the show hasn't been available suddenly in Australia for years and years, and only just around in the US in the last couple of months. LA Law, pretty much for the first sort of 1 to 2 seasons, there's not a lot of dramatic tension happening within the actual regular cast of the show. It was very much a legal case of the week, and they'd get involved in some of the guest stars that had come in each week. And then there was no arguments of any sort of real weight happening between any of the main characters. There was just no tension. And so, obviously, as they were tooling and retooling the program as it goes on, in the second season, suddenly a young African-American lawyer joins the firm, and it was clearly, I mean, I don't know if these culture conversations ever happened, but certainly it was, I'm sure, noted within the program how white the program really was. So you suddenly see the young African-American lawyer introduced into the program. And then the end of the second season, going into the third season, they introduce this character called Rosalind Shea, who's the character that falls into the stairwell, into the elevator shaft. She gets brought in to create some actual tension between her. She's a bit of a sly, nasty operator. From the first 1 or 2 episodes she's brought in, there's always like these offhand things of, I don't trust her. And they just keep on saying this. And what's kind of fascinating as well is that if you're a TV fan, you'll recognize that the actress who plays Rosalind Shea is Diane Mulder. She's the woman that gets introduced into the second season of Star Trek The Next Generation, playing Dr. Pulaski, who's the ship doctor. And nobody liked her in that either. And then she's just written out by the end of the second season. And then by third season, it just continues on. When Dr. Beverly Crusher gets returned to the program, as Pulaski had replaced her inexplicably. But it's just weird to see, like, she kind of plays the same character, which is just this sort of very cold, matter-of-fact, playing to her own agenda, ice princess sort of a character. And, like, all of it's kind of just a little bit too just badly gendered. And there's just, like, the worst of this kind of gendering of characters is very much in display with the Rosalind Shea character and, to an extent, the Pulaski character. But the dislike of Pulaski probably speaks more to the just awful misogynism of the viewers than it does probably necessarily what they were doing in the program explicitly. But that's neither here nor there. With this, they introduce this thing where she's like this nasty character. They play that through that storyline for about a season, and then they end up bringing it to a situation where she decides she's going to leave the firm. She's going to be fired, but she's like, nope, I quit. I'm out of here. And then a few episodes later, comes back and sues them for $2 million and wins the case. And so they all have to like search through their inner selves to work out if, you know, she actually was a terrible person, which she was. Like, it's all cool. But the main character, the head of the law firm, Leland, forms this relationship with her. And so he's keeping it a secret because he knows that it's not going to be well received that he's sleeping with a series villain from the last couple of seasons. And it was just kind of fun. They've woven this storyline through. And I don't know if the plan was to kill her as mercilessly as they did. But everything that leads up to that death in the elevator shaft is builds upon, like, it is like the ultimate culmination of what they did with the character. And for them to just like throw her literally into an elevator shaft, and the scene after that is them talking about the discovery of the body, and the body has stayed in this elevator shaft overnight because the police weren't able to extract the body out properly, as they found her lying in wires apparently in the elevator shaft. Just nasty. But it just sort of seems though like it was them kicking this character entirely while it's down. And what works about this as a TV death is just purely that they had built up this character to be such a awful presence. And the one thing the audience wanted was to see blood, like in a Roman Colosseum. We're all baying for it. And then they deliver it. And that's what makes it a great TV death. It's hilarious, but also earned.
That's a great TV death to start the segment off with. When I knew you were going to be talking about it, and I know we're going to move on very quickly, but I'll just say this. I did a little bit of research into what the death sort of represented. And apparently at that point in time, David E. Kelly, it happened in the fifth season, I think. David E. Kelly was leaving the show, and he was so in love with writing the Roslyn Shea character, he didn't want to put it in anybody else's hands. So he decided to bump her off instead of letting anyone else take control of her and take her in different directions. So that was his farewell to the series.
Yeah, I quite literally watched the last David E. Kelly episode last night, which is the end of the fifth season or sixth.
Cool.
Fifth, I think. Yeah, and you can see that he was writing ends for all the characters that he was clearly into along the way.
Yeah.
And then completely discarding the characters he didn't care for at all.
Let's move through the memorable deaths very quickly. For me, and I remember this happening, watching the episode, and when I saw the airing date, and this was the original US air date, it was probably a few months later here in Australia, on May 22nd, 1996, in the sixth season of Law and Order, in an episode called Aftershock, the beautiful Jill Hennessy was playing Claire Kincaid, and she was driving Jerry Orbach home after a night on the tiles. And just as she gives this beautiful sort of bit of dialogue back to him about how she's sure that his daughter doesn't hate him and how they'll get back together one day, she is killed in a car accident, which happens on screen, which is all seen by the audience. It's the end to the episode number 23 of season six. And I remember being totally shocked because back in 96, we didn't get any sort of, we didn't get a whole lot of information about what was coming out on the episodes. There would have been advertising on TV, of course, but there wasn't the internet to sort of prime us for these episodes. So when Jill Hennessy died in Law and Order, I remember being quite shaken because the Jill Hennessy, Benjamin Bratt, Jerry Orbach years are some of my favourite of Law and Order. So to have her leave the series was a big deal.
So this morning really bummed you out.
Do I look bummed out to you? You know, it wouldn't be so terrible.
What's that?
If you were my kid.
I guess I should take that as a compliment.
Hey, you're smart, you're pretty, you got a good job, and you don't hate my guts.
Lenny, I doubt your daughter hates you.
Oh, you don't know. You don't know.
My next one.
I should say, what's your next
death? This works very much on the same principle as the death of Roslyn Shea. The reason why this death, and certainly the third one I'm going to talk about as well, works so well is purely because there's actual momentum and a strong build up to them. So the death I want to talk about next is the excerpt from the series Mad Men by Jared Harris, who played Lane Price. With this is a character where for the 2 to 3 seasons prior, we'd seen as a very sort of prim and proper British gentleman who had some financial issues and certainly was playing on the margins of what was really considered to be polite and proper, both in terms of the way that society functions. So he gets very excited about visiting the Playboy Club and dating an African-American Playboy bunny who's working there. So he's doing that for a couple of episodes. And he's a married man, but his wife wasn't in the country at the time. So he's also just having affairs around the place, but it's kind of counter to what people expect from a man like that. It was just kind of interesting, but there's like this run of episodes where he's got financial issues. He's stolen some money from the advertising agency, and then it leads to him committing suicide in his office. And when it happens, like, it's a really sad moment. We've seen him like make a couple of attempts at suicide in, I think, the same episode, maybe the episode prior. trying to remember how it plays out exactly. But in typical Mad Men fashion, not only do you have the shock of seeing this character kill themselves, but they give you the cathartic laughs straight afterwards as a fair bit of Galloway's humor comes into it. Amazing death, only in that it is incredibly memorable, but also works completely to what that show did. And I think just sort of fit into the overall arc, the scope, the nature of what Mad Men was and what it meant to its viewers. It was just kind of a piece of all of it. It never felt like it was just a scene for shock's sake. It never felt like it was just an actor trying to leave the program that were writing it out. It felt so of the show that I think it's probably worth mentioning here.
There is a whole generation of people yelling at their podcast right, their podcast platform right now to mention my number two one. The death of Molly Jones is played by Anne Tenney in A Country Practice. I remember my entire household, mum, dad, sister, and I sobbing notably in her final moments. She passed away from leukemia in an episode called Molly Part 2, which was episode 32 of season 5. It aired on the June 5th, 1985.
Moving on, my final death that I just wanted to talk up was, and it feels a bit weird talking about this in light of the fact that I opened this talking about LA Law because it's another courtroom procedural, but also you talked about Law and Order, so like that's yet another lawyer who's dying a pretty sad death. The one I wanted to mention is, and this is a huge spoiler for people that haven't gone to the effort of watching The Good Wife, and they probably really should have. I've already mentioned The Good Wife, which means that anyone who knows that program knows immediately the death that I'm talking about here. This is the death of the Will Gardner character, a main character from the very beginning of this program. He was built up as the love interest for the protagonist in the series, the titular Good Wife. He was there. It was very much a will they, won't they, and they were very much a they are for about a season or so. Then the relationship broke up, and just as it sort of broke up, there was also some professional changes that the Alicia character sort of went through, and Will was built into being the villain of the program. And what was great is that he was such a beloved character, even though he was a little bit sort of slimy and a bit of a jerk, but kind of in a way that audiences love, and certainly she loved. But he becomes the villain of the program. And so it's this real thing where the audience is being tested as to whether or not they're willing to go along with one of the characters who was the most beloved character in the program suddenly being the bad guy in the show. And the show was so masterful that they kind of got away with that. And just as that relationship was starting to defrost a little bit, but there was still so much tension and so much anger happening between the lead characters in this program, they then go and kill this character in a surprise courtroom shooting, the likes of which we haven't seen on screen since LA Law. They did that a lot on LA Law. But no, there's a surprise shooting, which is, it's a really well-crafted episode of TV, but it functions so much better having watched the five seasons, leading into this shooting death. And it is just incredible. I don't know when they made the decision to kill the character, okay, but it felt, again, so much of the piece, and there was enough of a build-up to it that it felt really authentic and ingrained into the program. And I guess as I finish my TV deaths, I sort of think this is the recurring thing that really makes these deaths resonate with me. They're not deaths for shock value. They're deaths because it's the only thing that makes sense in the show.
Sure, and that's a tough decision to make, but if it's a popular character. For my last one, I had plenty to choose from. One of the deaths that really shocked me was when Zoe Barnes, played by Kate Mara, was pushed in front of the train on House of Cards. I remember when, even in the last year, we've had Logan Roy passing away in the middle of that episode of Succession, so that was a shock. When Shannon Doherty's character died. Yeah?
Sorry, just interrupting. Did you ever watch the UK House of Cards?
No, I didn't.
So the first season of that, because it was like three series, not seasons necessarily like they've got in the US, but the first series of that dies with like that version of the character being thrown off the top of the building, I think, from memory. It's actually a surprise when you watch the American one that she was still alive at the beginning of the next season. Okay. So like the death wasn't really the surprise as much as the fact that she was still alive in the program was kind of the surprise for people that knew the original series. So it was when they pushed it in front, it's like, oh, now they've done it. It was kind of like a weird cathartic relief to a certain degree.
Well, it was strange because her character was such a driving force of that episode, but what it was all in the service of was defining how evil the Kevin Spacey character was, which was very
pretty. Yeah. And who was the other death you mentioned? It was...
There was Logan Roy on Succession.
Logan Roy.
There was Mark Ring in AR when...
Okay, but was Logan Roy a surprise considering the entire show was built up as to what would happen when he dies? Like, it kind of feels as though his death was a certainty that we would see it. It was maybe just a surprise it happened that early in the season and not maybe four episodes later.
Yeah, absolutely. And the death of Mark Green, Anthony Edwards on ER, I remember having a huge impact and being very, very teary about. But the last one I'm going to go for is surprisingly from a comedy. Although as much as it's a black comedy, I guess, and there has been some memorable deaths in comedy over the years. Arguably the most famous episode of the Mary Tyler Moore Show was when the newsroom clown Chuckles dies during a circus parade. That's often cited as one of the funniest bits of television ever. The death of Susan on Seinfeld from toxic glue on the wedding invitations. Poor Lily. That was a tough one to take. And Maud Flanders' death in The Simpsons was also a shock when she got hit by several T-shirts shot from a cannon that knocked her off the top of the stadium. It was very funny, but very sad and very unexpected. But the saddest death from my generation was when Henry Blake, his plane got shot down over the Sea of Japan in an episode called Abyssinia Henry, season 3, episode 24. That aired in 1975. Now, I wouldn't have watched
show.
In 1975. Of MASH, I should say. Yes, Colonel Henry Blake on MASH passed away. The scene in which Radar comes into the room. Anyway, let's have a look at the scene. There's a short scene.
Radar, put a mask on. If that's my discharge, give it to me straight. I can take it.
I have a message. Lieutenant Colonel Henry Blake's plane was shot down over the Sea of Japan. It spun in. There were no survivors.
So yes, a very sad moment that I clearly saw in rerun because I wouldn't have stuck with me at 75, but it is a memorable moment that lived on forever and is often spoken of as one of the saddest. So that's our memorable deaths intermission episode.
I think it was really cathartic that we talked about TV deaths on this podcast because some people would say that every week on this podcast you witness a bit of a death. But anyway, Simon, this takes us into the segment we all love, which is what else have you been watching? And I'm going to go first. I've watched, well, a whole bunch of things this week, but I wanted to make particular mention of, I finally caught up on the new Netflix, we'll call it a drama. It's called Boy Swallows Universe. Look, two things. One, this takes place in 1985, thereabouts. 85, yeah. It also takes place in a suburb of Brisbane called Dara. If you don't know Dara, I never really know how to pronounce it. If you don't know it, it's kind of like Brisbane's version of Campbelltown. Not quite as far out, but certainly, you know, it's kind of like that. It's actually just a couple of suburbs down this direction from where I am. So you kind of come across some of the reputable suburbs and then something that just drops off a cliff and you find yourself in Dara.
God, we're going to get emails.
No, they can't afford internet. It's fine. Here's the thing. Here's the thing. I don't want to go to Dara. I don't want to really hang out with people from Dara. So the idea of watching a 7-episode Netflix drama series about people from Dara, not high on my list. That said, I heard people speak fondly of it. And there was something I felt weird while watching it, which was that one, the show's fine. I didn't really find it to be anywhere near as engaging as people seem to be talking it up. I was a bit more intrigued in the show, but only from the, here's what's coming up for the rest of the season, as opposed to what I'd actually watched for the hour previously. So I might come back to it because I'm kind of curious to see how the show moves from where we've seen it at now to where it is in those clips of what's to come. And I've never seen a Netflix series do, here's what comes in the rest of the season. So I don't know, maybe they recognize that people needed a bit more of a taster than what that hour represented, but that's neither here nor there. I did feel this very strange sense while watching it, that what I was experiencing wasn't so much that it was a show that people were loving for the right reasons, but instead, and I thought about some of the people that had told me how much they really enjoyed it, it felt a little sort of poverty porny, and the idea that you celebrate those who are like the Aussie battlers who are doing it tough versus being sort of genuinely passionate about the character. There's a bit of an ick factor about just that poverty aspect of it.
I'm going to comment on that very quickly because that's prodded the bear for me. I hate The Castle, the classic Australian comedy, for that very reason.
Yeah.
The working dog guys never felt any compassion towards this family. They were piss-taking through the whole film, and it puts me offside. I didn't feel that much about Boys
Club. Catherine Kim's kind of the same as well.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. I didn't feel that so much about Boy Swallow's universe. I thought there was an authenticity to these characters given the time and the setting and what the father puts them through. Terrific lead performance by Travis Fimmel as the farmer. And the two young actors who play the boys in the family are terrific. I really like Boy Swallow's universe. I agree with you that to a certain extent there's tonal problems to it. It is both a coming of age and a sweet sort of melancholy bit of sentiment, but it's also a crime drama in which people get their fingers chopped off and thrown in the boots of cars and that sort of thing. So it's a coming of age story in a tough neighborhood, and sometimes those two elements don't quite gel. But I actually thought it was a really well staged and well put together. Phoebe Tompkin as the mum is terrific as well. So I'm three episodes in and I'm kind of digging it. So
I'll
run with it.
Where I found the tonal issue, I think, is that if it was a straight crime drama, I'd probably have been a bit more into it. Or if it was purely a story about magic, I'd be into it. But there's something about the financial impoverishment of the characters layered in with this sort of magical element where you're supposed to feel it's like a little bit of a fairy tale at the same time. And I think that's where the gross vibe comes from with it.
Yeah, that's tough to pull off. What else have I been watching? I have to talk about very quickly a film that's in cinemas at the moment. It's called All of Us Strangers. Andrew Scott was, nominated for the Golden Globe for Best Actor for this one. In it, he plays a gay man living in an apartment block in London. He's a script writer. He's trying to come to terms with a little bit of writer's block. He decides to revisit the home he grew up in. What we learn as the story goes along, and this is a little bit of a spoiler, although it happens very early in the film, he actually returns to his home after many years. He lost his parents in a car accident when he was 12 years old, and by going back to his childhood home, he begins to have conversations with his parents at that age when he was young. So he's an adult man now and having very adult discussions with these 1980s type working class British people, played wonderfully by Jamie Bell and Claire Foy. They have to come to terms with his homosexuality. They have to come to terms with the fact that he's a writer, and they do it all in context of it being the 1980s. At the same time, he's establishing a relationship with Paul Mescal, who's a gay man he's met in his apartment block, and who he's redefining his romantic yearnings and his general love for life. This is such an emotionally charged film. It's done in a very understated way by director Andrew Haig, who did a movie called Weekend a couple of years back. And it is a film that absolutely knocked me for six. Great 80s soundtrack as well, including Pet Shop Boys and notably Frankie Goes to Hollywood. The Power of Love song is used to incredibly powerful effect in this film. This very quickly earned a position in my best of the year list because I was, it was, like I said in a post during the week, it's a million miles away from what I expected it to be. And just the stylistic way that it's presented is just beautiful. Great acting all the way through as well. So All of Us Strangers through Fox Searchlight in limited release.
Super quickly, I was at my mate Eddie's house during the week. I watched the movie Sorcerer. This is a film that I'd never, well, I certainly knew the movie existed. I knew it was a Friedkin film, but I always thought it, I mean, this is based on the name, I just thought it was going to be a magic thing. I was expecting wizards. So I didn't really know what I was doing. I didn't realize that would be the name of the truck.
Not that, Dan.
No, it is not. And like, it was welcome. I'd always been told the movie was good, but like, I just didn't know anything about it. Before I'd sat down to watch the film, I had watched the trailer that afternoon and realized what sort of genre it was. If you've never seen Sorcerer, I think fantastic. Go and watch it. Don't do any sort of pre-research into it, because I think the movie works best when you don't actually know what the movie is or what it's doing, because it is one thing at the beginning. Well, it's like four different things at the beginning because it's from different people's perspectives, and then becomes about one thing for the final half to final third of the movie. I think go with the surprise of it all. And then by the end of it, once you kind of have your druthers about you and know exactly what you've watched, you'll probably want to watch it again, because there's a craft that I am eager to go and explore a little bit more.
You know that I'm a fan of the cinematic folly. This was William Friedkin's folly after he'd hit big with The Exorcist and French Connection, and he was given a whole lot of money by 20th Century Fox to go to Brazil. I think it was Brazil or Argentina to make this completely nuts remake of Wages of Fear. It came out, it was 20th Century Fox's prestige summer title the year it came out. It opened exactly the same week as a little film called Star Wars. And when 20th Century Fox suddenly saw the box office takings for Star Wars, they said, well, we don't need Sorcerer anymore, so we can just dwindle away into nothingness and we'll concentrate on building up the Star Wars audience. So there's been a lot of films that have been left in the wake of the Star Wars franchise over the years, and Sorcerer was the first one.
You know what? Sorry, this is just an aside thing. This morning I was online and found a story about how apparently Jodie Foster was going to be playing Princess Leia, but then she ended up turning down the role sort of, you know, midway through negotiations on it. So one, that's George Lucas, who was after a much younger Princess Leia originally than was planned. This is an era where she was still in those Disney movies of the 70s. So, you know, certainly younger and spunkier.
And Cindy Williams. Cindy Williams was the other Laverne and Shirley star. Cindy Williams, who'd worked with Lucas on American Graffiti. But he was...
But that makes sense, though. Like, she was kind of like an... But she was like an adult woman, as opposed to Jodie Foster, who had been a teen at the time. And it really changed the dynamic of Star Wars in a really significant way.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Mm. All right. This is blowing out in only the way our podcast can. Let's whip through the In History section. This day in history, Dan Barrett, January 23, 1975, the character-driven misadventures of the detectives of the NYPD 12th Precinct Station House were introduced to American audiences on this day when which show premiered?
Now, I feel like I might be a year or two out, but my assumption is that we're talking about Barney Miller.
We are talking about the great Barney Miller, one of my favorite shows growing up as well. January 25, 1988, in one of American television's most fiery interviews, this is an incredible bit of television, I'll try and get you a clip for this as well, CBS Evening News anchor Dan Rather questioned Vice President George H.W. Bush about his role in which high-profile government cover-up?
Okay, the problem if we play a clip, Simon, is that as soon as we play the clip, people know what the answer is before I'm able to answer it. So I'm going to say...
See, that's producing on the run. Yep, go on.
Yeah. I'd say that what you did wasn't producing. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. I'm guessing it's like Iran-Contra.
The Iran-Contra arms for hostages, Reagan administration problem, yes, where they funded the Contras through sales of arms to the Iranian people and government. Finally, January 26, 1931, released on this day was the classic film Cimarron, I think it's pronounced, or Cimarron, the first film of its kind to win the Best Picture Oscar. In the history of the Academy Awards, only two other similar films have earned that honour. What's the connection?
So there's only literally one thing I know about this movie, and that is a Western. Mm. But I can't imagine that there's only been two other films that are Westerns. So I feel like the fact that it's a Western plays into this, but maybe there's a twist beyond that.
No, that is definitely the answer. There's only been two other Westerns to win the Best Picture, and they happened year after year, Dances with Wolves and Unforgiven. There is some argument, some debate that No Country for Old Men is like
that's
a
what I was just
Western.
Thinking. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. When I looked this up, there was like, well, it's kind of a Western, but it's sort of a modern gangster Western. So if you want to say that, there's four. But potentially... And he dances with wolves and Unforgiven, which is extraordinary, I think. Let's go straight to birthdays.
No, not happy birthday. No, not that. Please, no, not happy birthday.
This could be a tough one. Now, the clue is all in the names of these characters. What could be the thing that binds together Evan Peters, who was born January 20, 1987, Gina Davis, January 21, 1956, Natasha Kinski, January 24, 1961, and the man himself, Paul Newman, who was born on January 26, 1925. So if you look at those pictures there in the clue, if you're on our Facebook page or if you're down here, who's just opened the running sheet to check things out, what could be the thing that binds all these actors and their character names together?
Well, I presume they all played Dahmer at some point. So Evan Peters played Jeffrey Dahmer. Gina Davis played Susan Dahmer. Natasha Kinski played Eloise Dahmer. And Paul Newman played Johann Dahmer.
Thought it was going to be
correct.
Yeah, but no, that's definitely the answer. That's exactly right.
Sorry, what is it?
So all these people played characters who were in the title of the movies. They played title characters. Dahmer.
Oh, come on.
That's a good one.
You put into the notes, it's all in their character names. Like, that's me suggesting it's the character names. It's not the movie names.
No. I can't be held responsible for how you interpret my clues.
You stop putting clues into this because your clues are no good.
All right. So Evan Peters played Dahmer, of course, in the Netflix miniseries, 10 episodes back in 2022. Gina Davis was, of course, Thelma and Louise. She was one of them. I can't remember which one, but her name was in the title.
She was also in a buddy cop. She played Cutthroat against her co-star who played Island.
Cutthroat and Island, no. Well, she was also in a movie called Angie. She was in a TV series, all 13 episodes of Sarah back in 1985. And
she played Susan Commander in Commander in Chief.
Yes, exactly. Natasha Kinski was the beautiful Tess in the 1979 film based on Tessa the d'Urberville. She also made a film called Maria's Lovers, and she was Maria in that. And the man himself, Paul Newman, which indicates just how much control you have when you're a star as big as Paul Newman, he's had a bunch of movies named where he's been the title character. The picture I use there, of course, is Butch Cassidy in the Sundance Kids. He was Butch, but he was in Mr. and Mrs. Bridge, Harry and Son, Buffalo Bill in The Indians, The Life and Times of Judge Roy Bean, two classics in Harper and Hud. So he's been around for a long time, but most notably as Butch Cassidy. So that is this week's birthday quiz.
All right, Simon. I note here the running time. We've got an Emmy-sized conversation, which has taken us past an hour. Let's wrap things up.
We had a 12-minute review of Death and Other Details for some reason, but yeah, let's go with that.
Well, because there was a death. There was a death, and there were a lot of details.
And the other details, of course, that's which we had to cover. I know. Screen watching. See us on Facebook at Screen Watching Podcast Threats and YouTube at Screen Watching. And you can write to our email address, screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com.
You can find me on alwaysbewatching.com. It's a newsletter. It comes out every day with all the new stuff. Excuse me, a little burp as well. That's value adding for this
burped
podcast.
In the middle of the podcast. You burped in the middle of your own promotional segment. That's never good.
I just want people to know what they're up for. But the thing I'm talking about here is the alwaysbewatching.com newsletter. It talks about TV. It talks about streaming. It's all in there. It tells you what is always to be watched. Alwaysbewatching.com.
Nice.
Also, I do a podcast called Screen Watching.
Yeah, we know. It's been going for an hour and a half. Screen-space.net. is where you can see my writings. I've also started doing overnights with a young man called Mike Jeffries on Nine Media Radio, which is 3AW, 2GB, 4BC Brisbane, I think. Hear that on Monday mornings in those capital cities or via download. And I'll be down at Flickr Fest, Short Film Festival, all this weekend, depending on when this go out and then through next week, because I'm married to a jury member and I get free tickets. So I might see you there. Well, I won't see you there because you're in Brisbane, but I might see listeners there. Come up and say hi if you're at Bondi for Flickr Fest.
God, it's going to be awkward when suddenly you just see me there and we don't really have any conversation. We just kind of furtively look at each other from the distance.
How could we have anything possible to talk about after this, which is now running into its second hour?
Sorry, I've already checked out. Folks, this is Screen Watching. We'll be back next week with a podcast, which at the moment is scheduled to be 33 minutes, but then Simon will introduce 12 segments since the beginning, at which point it will be 3 to 4 hours. Folks, we'll see you then.